until the end of time. The permanence of Islam and the divine path and continuation of this path by God's servants are based on what Husayn ibn Ali alayhi salam and Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, did. That is to say, as a result of the great patience, resistance and endurance of hardships. You see that religious values have gained a lot of ground in the modern world. All these human values, which are consistent with human nature in different schools of thoughts, are rooted in religious values. These values have been promoted by religion. That is the nature of efforts for a divine cause.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The effort by US Republicans to examine voting equipment began soon after the November election, as former President Donald Trump blamed his loss on widespread fraud. Judges appointed by both Democrats and Republicans, election officials of both political parties, and Donald Trump's own Attorney General dismissed the claims. We now present you an article written by Christina A. Cassidy. The piece is titled, Experts Say Republican Election Audits Have Led to Voting System Breaches. The article has been published by the Associated Press news agency. U.S. Republican efforts to question former President Donald Trump's defeat in 2020 have led to voting system breaches, experts say, pose a risk to future elections. Copies of Dominion voting system software used for designing ballots, configuring voting machines, and tallying results were distributed at an event recently in South Dakota, organized by the MyPillow chief executive, Mike Lindell, a Donald Trump ally who has made unsubstantiated claims about last year's election. Matt Masterson, a former top election security official in the Trump administration, said, "We told election officials essentially that you should assume this information is already out there. Now we know it is, and we don't know what hackers are going to do with it." The software copies came from voting equipment in Mesa County, Colorado, and Antrim County, Michigan, where Donald Trump allies challenged results last fall. Dominion software is used in some 30 states, including California, Georgia, and Michigan. Harry Hursty, an election security pioneer, was at the South Dakota event and said he and other researchers were given three separate copies of election management systems that run under Dominion software. Data indicated they were from Antrim and Mesa counties. While it's not clear how the copies came to be released, they were also posted online and made available for public download. Harry Hursty said the release gives hackers a practice environment to probe for vulnerabilities and a roadmap to avoid defenses. All hackers would need is physical access to the systems because they are not supposed to be connected to the internet. Harry Hursty added, "The door is now wide open. The only question is, how do you sneak in the door?" U.S. election technology is dominated by three vendors, meaning election officials cannot easily swap out existing technology. Citing an investigation, a Dominion representative declined to comment. Kevin Skoglund, an election technology expert, said hackers could sabotage the system, alter ballot design, or even try to change results. He said, "This disclosure increases both the likelihood that something happens and the impact of what would happen if it does." The effort by Republicans to examine voting equipment began soon after the last November's election, as Donald Trump blamed his loss on widespread fraud. Judges appointed by both Democrats and Republicans, election officials of both political parties, and Donald Trump's own Attorney General all dismissed the claims. A coalition of federal and state officials claimed the 2020 election is the most secure in U.S. history, and post-election audits across the country found no significant anomalies. In Antrim County, a judge allowed a forensic exam of voting equipment after a brief mix-up of results led to a lawsuit alleging fraud. It was dismissed in May. Harry Hursty said that the date on the software release matches the date of the forensic exam. Calls seeking information from Antrim County's clerk and the local prosecutor were not immediately returned. A phone call to the judge's office was referred to the county clerk. The Michigan Secretary of State's office declined to comment. Colorado, authorities are investigating whether Mesa County Elections staff provided unauthorized access to systems. The county elections clerk, Tina Peters, appeared with Lindell in South Dakota and told the crowd she was being targeted by Democrats. Colorado's Secretary of State, Jenna Griswold, said she alerted federal officials of the breach and was told it was not viewed as a significant heightening of the election risk landscape at this point. This week, Mesa County commissioners voted to replace voting equipment Griswold ordered no longer to be used. Jeff Hale, who leads election security at the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, said his agency has always operated on the assumption system vulnerabilities are known by malicious actors. Jeff Hale said officials are focused instead on ways to reduce risk, such as using ballots with a paper record that can be verified by the voter and rigorous post-election audits. Jeff Hale said having Dominion software exposed publicly did not change the agency's guidance. Jack Cable, a security researcher, said he assumed U.S. adversaries already had access to the software. He said he was more concerned the release would fan distrust among the growing number of people not inclined to believe in the security of U.S. elections. Jack Cable, who recently joined a cybersecurity firm run by the former CISA director Christopher Krebs and former Facebook security chief Alex Stamos, said, "It is a concern that people, in the pursuit of trying to show the system is insecure, are actually making it more insecure." Concerns over access to voting machines and software first surfaced in Arizona, where the Republican-controlled state Senate hired Cyber Ninjas, a firm with no election experience, to audit Maricopa County results. The firm's chief executive tweeted support of conspiracy theories surrounding last year's election. After the county's Dominion voting systems were turned over, Arizona's top election official determined they could not be used again and ordered new ones. Dominion has filed lawsuits contesting unfounded claims about its systems. In May, it called giving Cyber Ninjas access to its code reckless and said it would cause irreparable damage to election security. Ryan Macias, an election technology and security expert who was in Arizona earlier this year to observe that review, was alarmed by a lack of cybersecurity protocols. There was no information about who was given access, whether those people had passed background checks or were asked to sign non-disclosure agreements. Cyber Ninjas did not respond to an email. Ryan Macias was not surprised to hear copies of Antrim County's system had surfaced online, given the questionable motives of the various groups conducting the reviews and the central role that voting systems have played in conspiracy theories. Ryan Macias said, "This is what I anticipated would happen, and I anticipate it will happen yet again coming out of Arizona." He added, "These actors have no liability and no rules of engagement."
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thousands of Palestinians have been arrested since the beginning of this year. The Israeli regime has swept into many areas, arresting young Palestinians because they are the most active in resisting Israeli occupation. Many of the youths who were arrested have received harsh sentences of 25 years in jail. Some are facing life. Others have not been charged but are still languishing away in jail. This is human rights, Israeli style. We've earlier talked to our correspondent in the occupied West Bank, and she shed some light on Israel's crackdown on Palestinians. Let's take a listen at what she had to say.
We are speaking about 1,900 Palestinians were arrested in Al-Quds, dozens of them, of course, so we are speaking about hundreds of Palestinian minors. Dozens of those 1,900 are under the age of 14. It's against all international laws, according to Palestinian human rights as well as international human rights. So it's an act to intimidate them as well as to prevent any Palestinian to be engaged in the different forms of resistance, struggle, or activities against the Israeli occupation. In addition to those arrests, since the beginning of 2021, Palestinian Human Rights said that all over the occupied West Bank, 1,000 Palestinian minors were detained by the Israeli forces. 130 Palestinian women were detained by the Israeli soldiers across the occupied territories. This brings the number of Palestinians who are still languishing in the Israeli jails of over 4,500 Palestinians, because the Israeli forces, the Israeli authorities, use the policy that's known as the revolving door. So at the time they release Palestinians who end their terms in Israeli jails, every day they storm and raid Palestinian areas to continue arresting more Palestinians across the occupied territories.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight. Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. And from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajareh out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us here on the Spotlight. Well, let's start this off with Mick. Israel embarks on night raids of villages, trying to cause as much fear and confusion as possible for Palestinians. They arrest young adults and many times even children and hold them without even charging them. I mean, what does all of this mean, that nothing is being done against this?
Well, your question contains the answer. The whole point is to instill fear and to terrorize the captive population of the West Bank. There was actually a group of quite prominent Zionist lawyers went to the West Bank a couple of years ago from London, very prestigious, big names, too expensive for me to be able to hire. And they came back absolutely shocked and stunned. And they said, look, this system is not a legal system at all. There's a 99.7% conviction rate. The whole purpose is to instill fear and terror into the Palestinian people, to demoralize and crush them. Now, that is my view, but I'm talking about the views of a group of Zionist high-flying lawyers who went there and came back and could not ignore that truth. The Israelis have a very big toolbox. One is jailing people. And as I say, the system they have is 99.7%. They also jail hundreds of people without trial. I forget the lady's name, but the woman who was ready to give birth in an Israeli prison a couple of days ago, or maybe she's delivered, I don't know. But she was jailed under legislation from the British era, which simply means you can be jailed because the authorities don't like you. They don't need to present evidence. And these six-month maximum jailings can be rolled over one, two, three, seven, 11 times. And so people live in a lawless situation. It's best to think of it as a situation of complete lawlessness. When a Palestinian approaches an Israeli checkpoint, his or her fate depends entirely upon the mood of an Israeli private or sergeant or whatever, and how that individual feels determines the life chances, the fate of a Palestinian. To have his ID confiscated because the soldier thinks he's impertinent or looks at him in the wrong way, that can wreck his life, can reduce his family from poverty to utter destitution because he loses his job. So the Palestinians live under this regime which is designed to terrorize them into leaving. It's really quite simple at one level, although it's quite sophisticated in its delivery.
Okay. Well, Masoud, the regime in Tel Aviv appears to be getting even more aggressive with an increase in trying to depopulate Palestinian areas and convert them into settler areas. I mean, your take on all of this?
Well, Mick is absolutely right, of the picture. But I think we should stop looking at just this particular clip of what is happening during the last 12 months or last year. This has been going on for the last 70 years, over 70 years. Ethnic cleansing, genocidal act, abuse of individual, creating fear as a tool of controlling masses. It's been going on for a very long time. And we all know that not just those who are in under occupation in Palestine, but indeed even the rest of us in the so-called civilized West, Europe and America and everywhere else, we actually are demonized seen as identified and promoted as a terrorist or anti-Semite just because we support the right of Palestinians to live as a human being. And the fact of the matter is that, we know from our experience to stand up against the oppressors, there is a price to pay. But the reality is that if we are not all willing to pay that price, united in collective way, then that price becomes much more. It will end up killing people, pregnant women, children, elderly, their houses being demolished. This is happening day in, day out. And indeed, the rest of us need to stand up. We actually have to sort of make this a priority. We cannot have peace in the region without resolving this illegal, oppressive, illegal occupation and the colonialism. That has to come an end for the region to start moving away from these violence. These violence by the Israeli Zionist state is not just being done by a small group of people. Systematically, youth, Zionist youth, Israeli youth, are actually taught how to hate and how to conflict damage on ordinary Palestinian and continued ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. We need to look at the whole picture. We need to look at what has been going on, not just last year, but for whole 70 years. And the international community has to take responsibility.
Okay.
Unless that's done, we are going to see more of this, and indeed more people are going to be silent And then the price for the rest of those who are standing against this operation, it will become much more heavy price to pay.
Well, Mick, young Palestinians are giving their lives on an almost daily basis, trying to free their people from this occupation, and still there is not the major international condemnation that should be taking place. I want you to explain that, especially now that Masoud was just talking about the international community and their need basically to step up to the plate.
Let's talk about two international communities. Let's talk about one, our political elites and corporate elites as well, who tend to be in strong support of Israel. But the Israelis also know very clearly that public opinion is swinging against them massively. And I think we should ask why, when Israel attacked the Palestinians just a couple of months ago, when the Al-Aqsa Mosque was under threat, when fascist gangs were roving inside 48 and attacking Palestinians, and when families were being thrown onto the street in East Jerusalem. When the resistance in Gaza came to the support of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and fired barrages of rockets into their own land, their own territory called Palestine, which Israel occupies at the moment, it's quite interesting that Israel did not go as far as they did with Operation Protective Edge or Cast Lead. They stopped after a relatively short period, and I'm sorry to say this, after killing only 100 or so Palestinians. Previously, they had killed 1,000 or 2,000 in these terrible massacres, the periodic massacres that they carry out. Why? I think Israel realized that it was headed for a disaster, that this was a political disaster for Israel, and the deep unpopularity that Israel is in public opinion was getting worse and worse and worse. Look, there are two extra dimensions to this that I would add to what Masoud says. One is the political tradition in Israel today, which was represented by Netanyahu and by the other dominant groups now, they don't think that they only deserve Palestine. They think that they also deserve Jordan. Their appetites are not restricted to the Jordan River. And the Palestinians, with their blood and the incredible heroism that you've just mentioned, the fact that these young men and young women continue to resist, they are not just defending Palestine, they're defending the peoples of the entire region, because the appetites of the Zionists don't stop at the Jordan River. The other dimension that I would add, if I may, is that one of the reasons it's gone on for so long, certainly the last 4 or 5 decades, is that it makes money, that the Palestinians are not only cruelly abused, they are monetized by the Zionist state, because the weapons, many of the weapons that were used in Afghanistan as part of the spending of $2 trillion, which ultimately was unsuccessful, but many of those weapons were tested on Palestinians and then sold by Israel to the USA. So the occupation can be a moneymaker for the Israelis. And it's also a moneymaker in a slightly lesser way. They charge, the Israelis steal most of the aid which is destined for Palestinians as humanitarian aid. And even if you speak to a Palestinian prisoner, we started off talking about the prisoners, if you're a prisoner in the Israeli dungeons, they feed you pig's fill. But if the families pay money, and it's a fair amount of money for their loved ones in these dungeons, they can be given better food. So, no, anything that resembles international law is violated by the Israelis, and mm-hmm. they even abuse the prisoners, not just in terms of cruel torture, which has been researched and shown by many, many bodies, but even at the level of depriving them of decent food, unless their families cough up extra money.
Okay.
It's blackmail all round. So yes, Masoud's right. This is a brutal system that's gone on for many, many decades, but it's got a certain grisly stability because of this money-making aspect to it.
Well, Masoud, what does all of this do to the psyche of young Palestinians, especially growing up with this backdrop day in, day out? Checkpoints, apartheid wall, night raids, demolition of homes, not having access to clean water or little electricity. I mean, what does this do to their psyche day in and day out?
Well, they realize, if they haven't realized before, they realize now that the only one they could rely on is themselves. Palestinians have got no other option than to resist this illegal, brutal occupation, this sort of colonial abuses that is taking place day in, day out. And, you know, it takes place despite whatever the Palestinians do. This is an ethnic cleansing systematically in place. And I just want to add one more thing to what Mick was saying, mm-hmm. and that is that Israel needs to create fear among its own citizens to justify this illegal, brutal occupation and this Zionism. And if there, if you know, so that actually is the need of this state. This state, this illegal state, is in need of conflict. Without conflict, it will not be able to justify its existence. And so, you know, this is going to go on, and Palestinians have got no other option. The real point is what the rest of us are going to do. Are we going to rise up and support the Palestinians? And how far we will go? And do we allow the lobby, the Zionist lobby, what they do in Britain and in United States and elsewhere, what they did with Jeremy Corbyn, what they're doing with the Jewish sort of pro-Palestinians in Labour Party and elsewhere, do we allow that to continue, or do we all unite and stand together? We are doing a good job, and actually I think we need to do more. We need to realize that, as Mick was saying, their days are outnumbered. The fact of the matter is more ordinary people are seeing the brutality of what's going on for what it is, and this sort of empty propaganda that this Zionist state is the only democracy in the region, it really is such a joke. But most people are waking up to the reality that is not the case, and we need to continue this resistance united and creating a better society and justice society for everyone in the region. And I think that's the way forward.
What about that, Mick? More people are waking up. Your take on that, and is that a sign of actually Israel not no longer being able to totally control the narrative as they have been? And is this a sign of waning power coming out of Tel Aviv?
It's much better than that. Not only are they unable to control the narrative, they've lost the narrative completely. If you and I are having a discussion, a debate, and it becomes pretty heated and it's very serious, and at a certain point in time I say, don't let her speak, it's because I've lost the argument. If I'm winning the argument, I don't need to silence you. I will carry on winning. Israel wants to silence Massoud, myself, everybody who speaks up for Palestine, without exception, and they want to silence these people because they have lost the argument comprehensively. When we started talking about 20 years ago about Israeli apartheid, we were of lone voices. Very few people would agree with us. And some people who were pro-Palestine said, oh, you're going too far. It's bad, but it's not apartheid. The argument is won. We've won the argument in terms of mainstream, decent, enlightened, and also indifferent public opinion. Israel has lost it. To call Israel an apartheid state, nobody raises an eyebrow. Of course it is. Jewish-only roads, two legal systems, one for Jews and one for Palestinians. It's not a discussion any longer. And you can tell this because Human Rights Watch, not a radical body, or the major Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, has come out openly to say Israel is a system based on Jewish supremacy from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. Not just in the West Bank, but everywhere the Israeli foot falls. So yes, they have lost the argument. The question is, how quickly can we turn this into such action that our elites, who are currently selling weapons to Israel, will be forced to do what they did with South Africa and abandon a regime whose only crime ever in their eyes will be to fail. You see, the South African regime, the corrupt regime that was ruling in Kabul until recently, the only crime they have that's recognized is failure. But once you fail, then you'll be discarded. We need to turn public opinion into, what can I say, like gas needs a piston to move, to channel it into effective solidarity. But we don't need to fight for public opinion. Israel's lost that already. The fight is to channel it into BDS activity.
What about that, Master? What does it take to expand this fight? Mick said that the argument has already been won. Now it's a matter of convincing the elites to stop supporting, the political elites to stop supporting that apartheid regime, and also increase pressure from civil society. Tell me, what is it going to take?
Everything, really. BDS, you know, we need to boycott everything Israeli and all the companies who are supporting the state of Israel. And they're extremely scared of this. And but we need to continue it. We need to actually do it religiously. We need to put pressure on the politicians. You know, we the politicians in so-called democracies in the West and Europe and the United States are going against the masses. The masses are becoming more pro-Palestinian, while the elite and the companies becoming more pro-Israeli. There are reasons for that. Mick mentioned some of it is economy and everything else. But we need to extend our work, and we need to expose every atrocity being committed by this Zionist state. And we need to actually make it as such, like South Africa, that people will be ashamed of supporting and associating with such a regime. When we achieve that, we have actually finally won the whole thing. Not just the argument among the civil society. We have gone all the way, and it will be end of this oppressive regime.
And Mick, do you think that we're getting closer to that day?
Who knows? Nobody knows. Nobody predicted a week before that the Berlin Wall would fall. Nobody could predict when the Shah of Iran would fall. You could say he will fall, but nobody could predict the time. It has never possible in a struggle against a brutal regime, it has never been possible to predict the hour or even the year of its fall. It will fall because it's unsustainable. The Palestinians will continue to pay a very, very high price. That price can be lowered by the peoples of the Middle East and the peoples around the world coming to the support of the Palestinians.
Okay, and
but
on
it
that
will continue
note,
to be a cruel struggle.
On that note, I thank both of you for being with me. We're out of time. Scottish, from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier of Edinburgh, and from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajarin, out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The unexpected and unwelcome coronavirus surge now unfolding in the United States has hit hardest in states that were slow to embrace vaccines. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Patricia Mazai, Benjamin Muller, and Robert Gabaloff. The piece is titled, What Went Wrong with the Pandemic in Florida? Stay with us for more. Unexpected and unwelcome coronavirus surge now unfolding in the United States has hit hardest in states that were slow to embrace vaccines. And then there is Florida. While leaders in that state also refused lockdowns and mask orders, they made it a priority to vaccinate vulnerable older people. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, opened mass vaccination sites and sent teams to retirement communities and nursing homes. Younger people also lined up for vaccine shots. Governor Ron DeSantis and public health experts expected a rise in cases this summer as people gathered indoors in the air conditioning. But what happened was much worse. Cases spiraled out of control, reaching peaks higher than Florida had seen before. Hospitalizations followed, so did deaths, which are considerably higher than the numbers currently reached anywhere else in the United States. It's a very sad, sad moment for all of us, said Natalie E. Dean, a biostatistician at Emory University who until recently worked at the University of Florida and has closely followed the pandemic in the state. It was really hard to imagine us ever getting back to this place. The Florida story is a cautionary tale for dealing with the current incarnation of the coronavirus. The United States has used the vaccines as its primary pandemic weapon. But Florida shows that even a state that made a major push for vaccinations, Florida ranks 21st among states and Washington, D.C., in giving people of all ages at least one vaccine shot, can be crushed by the Delta variant, reaching frightening levels of hospitalizations and deaths. Clearly, the vaccines are keeping most of these people out of the hospital, but we're not building the herd immunity that people hoped, Ron DeSantis said at a news conference this past week. You've got a huge percentage of people, adults, that have gotten vaccine shots, and yet you've still seen a wave. Morgues and crematoriums are full or getting there. Public utilities in Orlando and Tampa have asked residents to cut back on water usage so liquid oxygen, which is used in water treatment, can be conserved for hospitals. As of Friday, 27th of August, Florida was recording an average of 242 virus deaths a day, nearly as many as California and Texas combined, though a few states still had a higher per capita rate, according to public health data tracked by the New York Times. Florida's pandemic data, more scant since the state ended its declared COVID-19 state of emergency in June, reveals only limited information about who is dying. Hospitals have said upward of 90% of their patients have been unvaccinated. Exactly why the state has been so hard hit remains an elusive question. Other states with comparable vaccine coverage have a small fraction of Florida's hospitalization rate. The best explanation of what has happened is that Florida's vaccination rates were good, but not good enough for its demographics. It has so many older people that even vaccinating a vast majority of them left more than 800,000 unprotected. Vaccination rates among younger people were uneven, so clusters of people remained at risk. Previous virus waves, which were milder than in some other states, conferred only some natural immunity. And Florida is Florida. People have enjoyed many months of party going and traveling, all activities conducive to swift virus spread. Unlike in places like Oregon, which is clamping down again, adopting even outdoor mask mandates, Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, continues to stay the course, hoping to power through despite the devastating human toll. A Quinnipiac University opinion poll released this past week found that Ron DeSantis' approval rating was 47%. He and other Florida state officials have sought to steer away from measures that could curtail infections, banning strict mask mandates in public schools. The biggest school districts imposed them anyway, and on Friday, a state judge ruled that Florida could not prevent those mandates, a decision the Department of Education plans to appeal. Florida has experienced more deaths than normal, from all causes, not just COVID-19, throughout the pandemic. In the early weeks of 2021, with cases surging and the vaccine rollout kicking off, the state averaged 5,600 deaths each week, about a third more than typical for that time of the year, according to mortality figures from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. The deaths dropped and then went back up again. These excess deaths are important, both because a number of COVID-19 deaths occur outside of hospitals and because the virus may contribute to deaths from other causes as a result of the strain on the healthcare system. In the first week of August, the state recorded another 5,600 deaths, but because mortality rates normally drop during summer months, the figure was more than 50% above what's typical. "We're seeing a ton of people calling us to report the COVID deaths," said Dr. Stephen J. Nelson, the Polk County medical examiner. "They're typically young people that have been sick for a while. The picture of who is dying, however, is complicated. About 82% of people 65 and older in the state are fully vaccinated, about average for the nation. That has still left a relatively large number of older people, about 819,000, unvaccinated or only partially vaccinated," said Jason Salemi, an epidemiologist at the University of South Florida. "If the unvaccinated also take fewer other precautions," he added, "that would put them directly in the virus's path." "The Delta variant is exceptional at finding vulnerable populations," he said. "The situation in nursing homes, where infections can spread swiftly, has also been problematic. While vaccination rates among older Floridans as a whole have been good, the rate of nursing home residents who are fully vaccinated, an average of 73.1% in each home, is lower than every state but Nevada, according to the CDC. About 47.5% of nursing home staff members were fully vaccinated as of 15th of August, the lowest of any state but Louisiana. Older people are also more likely to have immune deficiencies and comorbidities, making them more susceptible to breakthrough infections and hospitalizations," noted Dr. Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease specialist at the University of California, San Francisco. "And some, though not all, data have suggested that immunity against infection has waned in older, vaccinated adults. The Biden administration has indicated that those people will be among the first in line for booster vaccine shots. Then there are the younger people who now make up a larger share of Florida virus deaths. Before 25th of June, people under the age of 65 made up 22% of deaths. Since then, that proportion has risen to 28%. 56% of people between the ages of 12 and 64 in Florida's 10 largest counties are fully vaccinated, which is consistent with national figures. But in the rest of the state, that figure is only 43%, and in 27 counties, less than 1 in 3 residents in the age group is fully vaccinated. the heart-wrenching deaths of children remain rare. The deaths of young and middle-aged adults have become routine. My mum had no prior illnesses. She was strong as an ox, said Trey Burrows, whose 50-year-old mother, Cindy Dawkins, died from COVID-19 on 7th of August. There was literally nothing wrong with her. This just came out of nowhere. Ms. Dawkins, a mother of four who worked in a restaurant in Boynton Beach, Florida, began to feel ill shortly before her birthday, as the family was en route to celebrate in Orlando. Ms. Dawkins developed a cough and shortness of breath. 4 days later, she went to hospital. Doctors placed her on a ventilator. 32 hours later, she was dead. Her son said she had not gotten vaccinated because she feared possible side effects. Those who did not get vaccinated are only part of the explanation behind the surge. Many states slammed by the virus earlier developed deep reservoirs of natural immunity from prior infections, affording them higher levels of protection than would be evident from vaccination rates alone.